Okay, so there's been quite a lot of progress in the observational unfolding of the universe beyond a redshift of 5 in the last, say, year or so, and hope in this talk is to try to give you some flavor of the prospects for extending the surveys to redshift 10. And I think the bottom line is we're quite optimistic that there's a lot of opportunities for exploring this era. So the motivation, as we heard yesterday, is that there's significant evidence piling up that there are radiating sources earlier than a redshift of 6. We've got, I suppose you could say theory predicts it. We have the abundance of metals that can't have been produced in the Big Bang out to the highest redshifts that we can probe. We heard from Fan and collaborators about recent developments in the Gunn-Peterson trough. And we're eagerly awaiting the verification of the optical depth in electron scattering from the second year of WMAP data. And that will be very important, I think, in guiding us. So all of these independent developments point indirectly to reionization occurring earlier than a redshift of 6. It looks like star-forming systems are the most promising. That may not turn out to be the case, of course, but until we actually try to find them, we won't know. And so the big question that's motivating many observers now is, can we trace this star formation at early times, and can we find the relevant epoch? And it's very challenging, even with the most powerful facilities, not just because the luminosity distances are very large, but the earliest systems are likely to be very low mass. And so we're not looking at L-star objects at early times, we're probably looking at a large population of lower mass systems. Technically, it's no surprise that the barrier that we're at, the redshift 7, is actually a technological barrier. It's a barrier between the optical regime, where we have over 20 years built up panoramic optical cameras and efficient spectrographs with multi-object capabilities. We're now moving into the near-infrared, where the technology for panoramic imaging is relatively new, and where we don't really yet have multi-object spectroscopy. So a lot of this is motivating new instruments and, in the far future, new facilities. And even if it's going to be difficult and we won't actually completely unravel this with our current facilities, it's going to be very important that we place constraints on what's out there. At the moment, we have very little idea of the redshift distribution of sources, the masses, and so forth, because any information that we have will better enable us to exploit future facilities and design experiments with those more productively. So the strategy that we've been adopting at Caltech with collaborators in Cambridge and Arizona is twofold. One, we've, along with many other groups, we've started looking at the public data sets that have come out of Hubble and looking at the abundance of star-forming sources. These are extraordinarily deep images from Hubble. They're the deepest available, but they're very small fields of view. So cosmic variance is a very big uncertainty, but they're a very good indication of what's feasible, give us a very good idea of what the challenges are in exploring this, this era before a redshift of 6. This gives us, if you like, a statistical measure of the abundance of sources. We can't actually always verify that each individual source is at a specific redshift, because many of these objects are too faint for spectroscopy. What we can do, however, is in very small areas of sky, we can locate via strong gravitational lensing individual objects that we can study in more detail. And I'll go through this. The magnification allows these objects to be boosted. We can study them astrophysically in much more detail. Of course, we assume that the few objects that lie in this regime are drawn representatively from probably the fainter end of the luminosity function of these sources. So these two probes are complementary, and I'll illustrate what we're learning from them. Just to emphasize the students who've worked on this, Dan Stark is a new graduate student at Caltech. He's working on an extension of this lensing technique that Mike Santos, who was a student at Caltech, now at Cambridge, worked on. Elizabeth Stanway was a student of Andy Bunker in Cambridge, and we've been working together on the first of these two projects. So how would you know if you found a population that was adequate to reionize the universe? Well, the short answer is you'd ask a theorist, and one of the two famous papers that Piero produced, I think he probably produced a few more, this one, which gives a prescription for the surface density of star-forming objects that would be necessary to reionize the universe. And of course, it's a theoretical prediction, it's an analytic expression. There are many imponderables that we've been discussing in all of these ingredients. And maybe numerical simulations will be the only way of addressing all of these imponderables and understanding exactly how to interface data with theory. What I want to illustrate is that there's a great deal of uncertainty. If you put reasonable ranges of parameters into this equation, you can easily uncover a factor of 10 uncertainty in the surface density of star-forming objects that would be necessary in any given redshift range. There are some pretty profound observational problems with just going out and counting objects and then comparing it with this prediction. One is, of course, we don't know the redshift range. We can make a measurement of the abundance of objects at some redshift, but then it would be ridiculous to imagine that those objects simply appeared at that redshift with a Schechter function. Somehow they must have had some history that got them there. And then also, of course, as with any experiment, we only are sensitive to objects down to some luminosity limit. And the extrapolation of the luminosity function below the limit of detectability is essential in making the integrated photon budget in any cosmic volume. So this plot, which is very simple but I think very illustrative, came out in Schiavelli, Fall, and Panagia about a year ago, and it gives a good indication of the problems that observers face in matching predictions with data. It shows, and I've adapted this, so I've just said, let's imagine that the bulk of the effort done by star-forming sources lies between a redshift of 7 and 10, so it's just an arbitrary assumption. Then what would be the surface density of those sources per square arc minute as a function of their star formation rate for some luminosity function that would be necessary to cause cosmic reionization? If you lie down here, where the surface density is low, you don't produce enough UV photons, somewhere in this region would be okay. And if you have an overabundance of photons, then you're in danger of violating the production of metals that we see in the intergalactic medium. Now, the problem is that if you just look at the scale here, this covers many orders of magnitude. And so the challenge is, do you search for a rare population of objects with star formation rates comparable to the Lyman-Brake population, say 10 solar masses per year, which would require a survey that has a wide field of view, surveys large areas of sky, and looks for rare objects? Or do you go very deep and narrow and look for a high abundance of feeble objects with star formation rates less than a solar mass per year? And of course, the strategies and the technology that you would adopt for both of those are very, very different. And in practice, we need to know the luminosity function to understand the relative merits of both, and we don't. So the place to start, I think, is in the dropout technique, and I'll just go through this. There are three groups that have been working intensively on the dropout technique. So these are continuum sources, and the signature of the Lyman alpha absorption at high redshift enables you, in principle, to isolate objects at redshift 6, in the case of the I dropouts, at redshift 7 or so, in the case of the Z dropouts. And the two big data sets that have become available in the last 12 to 18 months are the Goods fields. So these are north and south, 400 square arc minutes. And the UDF, which has two components, a ACS area, which is about 11 arc minutes squared, so it's a single pointing of the ACS. And then there's a small overlap region of about 140 arc seconds square with NICMOS. And it's the combination of the UDF and NICMOS in this tiny area that allows Bouins et al. To produce the first abundance of Z drops. Don't get excited, they only found four. Okay, so that gives you an idea of the territory. Okay, so now unfortunately, you're probably very familiar with the U dropouts and the B dropouts and so forth. These have been very productive in isolating galaxies at redshifts 2 to 5. The technique that is adopted is exactly the same. So here's the goods data from Stanway's thesis. So here's I minus C against Z. And in this survey, we cut at about 25.6. You can see if you go too faint, then the photometry becomes quite noisy. You start to pollute this region of dropouts with noisy objects. We thought that by going to this limit, we would be able to get spectroscopy at Keck and verify that many of these were at this redshift. This is actually crucial because unlike the lower redshift dropouts, where the contamination is very small, you know, we're talking about 1% or 2% at most for, say, the U dropouts or the B dropouts from lower redshift contaminants, the universe is populated with red things. And as you go to longer wavelengths, you start to see low-mass stars in our own galaxy. Okay, they lie almost in exactly the same color space as the dropout candidates. So here's I minus C, here's the dropout signature. Okay, so to the right of this is a dropout by definition. Here's optical minus infrared. Here are tracks for red passively evolving galaxies. So you can see that red objects at redshift 2 lie in the dropout territory. In principle, they can be eliminated if you have infrared data that's deep enough. But the L dwarfs, which have these titanium oxide absorption bands mimicking the dropout signature, lie uniformly in the same area as the high redshift candidates. Now, of course, you have Hubble data, so you can look to see whether they're resolved. And so the combination of optical infrared color and half-light radius of the dropout candidates allows you, in principle, to isolate candidates for spectroscopy. Now, there is one very important caveat here that is crucial to make, and that is there are regions in surface brightness space that even with these extraordinarily deep Hubble images, we're not probing. So, for instance, there could be very diffuse objects with low surface brightnesses that could be contributing UV photons, and we would not see them even in the deepest Hubble images that we have. So that's an important problem. Now, NICMOS gives you an indication of what we would be able to do if we had this wide field camera 3 with Hubble, because unfortunately these axes are flipped, but here's optical minus infrared, here's I minus C again, here's the dropout signature. You can see that the candidates at high redshift are now separated very nicely from the ellipticals. And so by going deeper in this central region of the UDF, you can try to determine what the contamination rate is from low redshift ellipticals. And it looks to be relatively modest, which is good news. Okay, so you might be asking, well, why can't we just get spectra and measure the redshifts of these things and be done with? Well, we've tried that to this limit of 25.6, sure enough. We included a few candidate stars, and you can see that here's the spectrum of an L star, so a bright L star, and here are some of the objects in Goods North, and you can see they are indeed L-type dwarfs in this. We see Lyman alpha emission. There's a few more objects with Lyman alpha emission. If Lyman alpha is present, then it's very straightforward. If Lyman alpha is not present, then many of the spectra, we simply don't know what the objects are. So the bottom line is that if you try to construct a luminosity function using the half-light radius, the infrared colors, and the spectroscopy, you have a good spectroscopic sample down to about here, so it's 25.6. The region from 25.6 up to 27, which is the limit of the Goods data, you really have to just appeal to photometry and size. And then the UDF, basically, apart from this overlap with the NICMOS area, which is a subset of the data, there's no spectroscopy at all. Well, if you do the best possible guess, then you can see that you can construct a luminosity function for these objects. And it seems to have a shape, at least to 28.5, that's broadly comparable to what the Lyman Brake galaxies show at redshift 3, but scaled down by a factor of about 6 or so. So this would indicate that there's a population of well-established objects that have broadly the same luminosity function at a redshift of 6 or so, with about the same shape of the luminosity function, and the steepness of that luminosity function is the same as at lower redshift.
You see continuum radiation from these redshifts?
Yeah, these are all dropouts. So these all have basically, you know, detected continuum with Hubble. So if you put that on the other famous Madao paper and look at the observed UV emissivity, so this is, of course, not corrected for any dust effects. We're just interested in the UV photons that escape. So this may not necessarily be the star formation rate. Then there's this marked decline between a redshift of, say, 3 or so and a redshift of 6. Now, in so much as you can make a prediction, and this is where the different observers have come to slightly different conclusions, I want to pause and spend some time going through the different viewpoints on this relatively new and meager set of data. The question is, you know, where would we expect the abundance of UV photons at this redshift to be consistent with reionization? What kind of territory would we expect the data to occupy? And you can see that in my own calculation, it's just about consistent, but at the low end of the distribution. And if it continues to fall, as I think it does, with the Z drops, and of course there's some contamination that we haven't allowed for, which will lower the true sources at this redshift even greater, then, you know, it looks like there's an inconsistency. But of course that could be some theoretical uncertainty. So let's stop just for a minute and look at what the possibilities are here. So it looks like most of the observers agree. There are three independent papers on this. There was a little sort of workshop at Space Telescope about a month ago. Some of you were there, I think. And you'll remember that basically the observers do agree on the abundance of sources. It's the interpretation of this low abundance that, where there's some disagreement. So let's imagine that reionization did end at redshift 6. You know, maybe the WMAP optical depth will come down. Then, you know, what could this mean? Well, it's theoretically possible. Schiavelli has a preprint which claims that the sources that we found are consistent with a population that ended reionization. He appeals to lower metallicities and a steeper initial mass function, and that would place it at the bottom end of the distribution. The idea here is, of course, that the lower metallicities would lead to a steeper UV contribution integrated down to Lyman alpha. We could have simply been unlucky. The calculations of cosmic variance in these small fields are, you know, at least tens of percent. In the UDF, in the ACS area of the UDF, it's 40%. In the NITMOS area, it would be even greater. In the GOODS area, we have two fields. We think the fluctuations will be around about 10%. So it may be that we've simply underestimated the true abundance of these sources. And there's evidence that they're clustered as well, and that's very important. Now, Yan and Windhorst have claimed that by pushing the UDF to fainter limits than anybody else, that they detect a steeper faint end slope than the Lyman break luminosity function. So let's just look at that. Here's their paper, posted about a month ago. And we stopped at 28.5, I think, in the UDF. And that's what we concluded, that the luminosity function there was consistent with the Lyman break population. They have pushed it to about 1.5 magnitudes fainter, to a ZAB of 30. And they admit that at this limit, the data is incomplete. So they have a very complex modeling process which tries to account for the incompleteness by putting in artificial objects, trying to recover them, and getting an incompleteness function. If they do that, they claim that the faint end slope is steeper, minus 1.9 compared to minus 1.6. And that makes quite a difference in the integrated luminosity density. So they would then argue that the luminosity function is steepening as you go from the Lyman break population out to a redshift 6. And so the correction that you make for the unobserved sources is underestimated by some factor, which would bring this point up and account for reionization. So the key issue, of course, is this correct? We're not going to get another Hubble Ultra Deep Field very soon. So, you know, this really requires deeper observations, maybe infrared observations. So we're not really sure, you know, how to resolve this discrepancy. Let's imagine that reionization ended at higher redshift. Then we would expect objects at higher, at earlier times. And so the question then is to go and find them. So here's the four objects that Bouins et al. Claimed to find with NICMOS, no spectroscopy, again, a continuing trend out to a redshift of 7. Is there any prospect of measuring redshifts for these fainter objects? There are two techniques that are being discussed. One is the nod and shuffle spectroscopy on Gemini. Here's a candidate Lyman alpha emitter from Stanway and collaborators, somewhat fainter than the Keck spectroscopy. Extremely noisy data, as you can see, possible detection here. And then this GRISM on the Hubble Space Telescope, which unfortunately doesn't really have the resolution to do precision work, but may be able to locate breaks if the objects are bright enough. So let me turn now to the Lyman alpha emitters, and I think Len will probably say a little bit more about this. These are very efficient tracers of star formation, but they're particularly sensitive to neutral hydrogen. And so they're very valuable tracers of its existence, particularly for the weaker objects. So this is a simulation done by Mike Santos, which just takes a Lyman alpha emitter at a redshift of 7 and imagines reionization ended sometime between a redshift 7 and 6. This is a luminous Lyman alpha emitter at the kind of flux level that you would expect in a narrowband imaging survey. And you can see that although the line is damped and extinguished, the emission still is detected. Whereas if you can go further down the luminosity function where the line is intrinsically weak, then the line is almost completely obliterated. So if you can get down the luminosity function, then the slope of the luminosity function in Lyman alpha emitters and the abundance as a function of redshift of the intrinsically faint ones could be a very, very sensitive test. So that's why we've started looking at the critical lines of high magnification in rich clusters. So this is a cluster of galaxies at a modest redshift of 0.18. And these lines represent the formal lines of infinite magnification at redshifts 1 and 5. And there are about 20 such clusters for which the location of these strong magnifying critical lines is reasonably well constrained. So the idea is, first we did this optically with low res. We started scanning in a blind mode these regions around the critical line for Lyman alpha emitters. So we find a Lyman alpha emitter in blank space, and then we go back and measure its, we find indeed that it is a lensed pair. We go with a higher dispersion spectrograph and verify that it is indeed Lyman alpha with its characteristic asymmetric profile. And so we're able to locate objects that are intrinsically much fainter than in the narrowband imaging technique. So the unlensed flux is about 2 times 10 to the minus 18. It's about 20 times fainter than in a direct imaging survey. And this object is probably forming stars at around about half a solar mass per year. Now, we did a survey for these. This was part of Santos's thesis. We found 9 clusters, and we scanned all of these critical lines with low res. And we were able to find 11 such lensed objects, not all at high redshift. And what we found was that the luminosity function in Lyman alpha at around a redshift of 5.2 or so is somewhat flatter than we would have expected and somewhat depressed compared to what we see in the star-forming continuum sources. So it would be very important, I think, to verify at higher redshift whether this suppression of the faint end slope is true, because it could mean that there's neutral hydrogen even at these redshifts. Now, I want to just say 2 more things. One is that we've found a source at near a redshift of 7, which is highly magnified, and for which there's much more detail of its physical nature than any of the other objects that have been found by the Lyman alpha technique. And that comes from its detection with Spitzer, which is a mid-infrared telescope. So here's the original detection. So this is here's the critical line again. And here's the split pair. And you can see it's not present in the optical. It's seen in H and in Z band and then drops away. We think it's magnified by a factor of 25 or so. It's the mass model predicted a third image down here. Precisely, we recovered it with the right position and brightness. And this object, we tried very hard to get the redshift. We think it's somewhere between a redshift of 6.6 and 7. We looked very hard with an infrared spectrograph and with an optical spectrograph. We can't exclude a Lyman alpha emission in this region here, around about 6.8 or so. So here's the Spitzer detection, which I think was quite unexpected. So Spitzer, remind you, doesn't have the resolution of Hubble, but is a mid-infrared telescope, so it's giving you access to the rest frame optical at these redshifts. So it's really very important, because up until now, all of the information we've had has been in the UV. So we haven't been able to probe the more established stars in this object. The detection of both images, the two split pair here, is significant, about the 4 sigma level. And the spectral energy distribution of the object shows that there is indeed a reasonably well-established stellar population for this object. The photometric redshift is 6.8. Star formation rate's about 2.5 solar masses. It's quite a reasonable stellar mass. It's about 10 to the 9 solar masses. And the key thing here is that in all the spectral energy distribution fits for this object, the age is longer than the E-folding star formation time. So this object would have been more luminous in the past. Depending on its age, it probably formed somewhere in the region redshift 8 to 12 or so. And because we searched such a small area for this object, then this object has been producing UV photons over an extended period, out to redshifts of 10 perhaps. And such sources may be quite common, unless we've been extraordinarily lucky in locating it in this very small surface area that we've studied so far. So we're going to get a GRISM in a couple of weeks. We'll get a GRISM spectrum from Hubble of this region here, which will tie down the UV continuum and measure the redshift more precisely. So piecing it all together, there's this low abundance of dropouts, and that suggests perhaps there's an extended star formation history if these star-forming sources are responsible for reionization. The Spitzer and Hubble photometry identifies a clear example of an object that's long-lived. It's been producing UV photons over 200 million years, perhaps. And given the small area that was used to find it, such sources are likely to be quite common. Now, returning to the Hubble data, if the abundance is too low compared to the predictions, it may simply mean that the luminosity function is steep. And if this is not the case, then it's very important to continue surveying for higher redshift objects. Now, this is a dangerous thing to do. Going beyond a redshift of 7 has drawn much attention by Dave Barry, who many of you will know, and he basically recently said that astronomers at the prestigious Krudwinkel Observatory have observed a teensy light smudge, etc., etc. However, astronomers at the rival Fendelman Observatory charged that what the Krudwinkel scientists discover is actually mayonnaise on the lens. Both groups of astronomers say they plan to use these new findings to obtain even larger telescopes. So a lot of truth in that. So just to conclude, we're now searching in the infrared with this mapping technique. This is Dan Stark's project. So this is these are much smaller areas, but we've already demonstrated that we can get down to very high sensitivity. So it's a critical line here. These are areas that we're scanning in the J band. So this will be sensitive to redshifts between 8 and 10. And the limiting flux that we're getting to allows us, in the unlensed case, to get down to star formation rates that are really very, very modest, less than a tenth of a solar mass per year. So just to conclude, we're going to get observations that will take us right down to this limit here. And I think we expect to find, just by scanning 12 clusters, we would expect, if this steep luminosity function at redshift 7 is correct, we expect to find about 5 to 10 sources between a redshift of 8 and 10. Thanks very much.
Richard, those lines for Lyman alpha emitters using clusters, for searches for Lyman alpha emitters using clusters, and those lines of magnification, this magnification of a given source is very sensitive to where the line is because it's basically falls
right.
very rapidly.
Right.
So how certain you are that all the systematic errors and you didn't know where the lines are, and so that the prediction
okay.
for the number densities are reliable?
Okay.
It's a very significant selection function. It's a highly
right.
non-trivial selection function.
Right. So the question is, I think there's two aspects to this question. One is just, you know, for these particular clusters, how well is the actual angular location of these critical lines established? The answer to that is that it varies from cluster to cluster. In the best clusters, one can explore what happens if you remove, in like a bootstrap way, some of the multiple images and their redshifts. Obviously, the way in which these critical lines are mapped is after a lot of effort of measuring the redshifts of all the lower redshift multiples and the arcs and everything, and build up a geometrical model of how the critical line is changing as a function of redshift. So you can experiment in a particular cluster like the one I showed, 2218, by patching out individual multiples and seeing what happens to the location of the critical line. And it's really very, very, changes very, very little. And as you go, say, less than an arc second. So for example, probably people don't believe me unless I actually, you know, demonstrate in a particular case. Here's the pair at 5.6 that I showed you. You know, now, of course, once we knew the location of this, the position of the critical line must go right through the middle here at a redshift of 5.6. This object is 6.8. We can predict its redshift. We can determine the position of the third image. So all of these give verifications of the mass model. Now, the second part of the question is more profound, and that is, if the object is resolved, okay, then its location in the source plane close to the critical line means that across it, different parts of it will be magnified by slightly different amounts. And that's, you know, that's quite a concern. That's at the sort of 15 to 20% level. So typically when I say an object is magnified by a factor of 30, you should say 25 to 35.
Richard, when you quote the requirements for reionization,
right.
I think what you're quoting are the requirements at a particular redshift for maintaining ionization.
Right.
Whereas the actual requirements for bringing reionization about are an integral over time.
Right.
And if it's stars, then it's an integral over that star formation rate.
Right. Well, I.
So you can't really know whether you have explained reionization by the instantaneous number. You need to know the integrated number.
I agree.
So
in the plot I showed, I attempted to calculate the integrated volume of UV photons, say, between a redshift 7 and 10. I only observe in a discrete redshift interval, say 6 plus or minus 0.5. So I would then assume that that volume density of sources is constant, say, out to redshifts of 10 or so. And I think most people are assuming that. When they say, and there's been a lot of sloppiness, I think, in the quick papers that have come out of UDF, that when they say that there's insufficient or adequate numbers of objects to cause reionization, what they're really saying is that over some interval in time, say between, you know, plus or minus 2 in redshift interval, that's consistent with the abundance that we see at redshift 6. But you're right, it's a good point.
Now, just to follow that up, it is also the case that even the integral number and its time history are theoretically unknown. So you can't really put on your observational constraints a box that says, you know, we do or we do not have enough photons, even in the assumption that you make, even if you're clear about what assumptions you make. Theoretically, we haven't figured out exactly how many photons it takes.
I thought thought I said...
So there's some uncertainty there.
Yeah. I thought I said that you hadn't figured out how many photons there were, but anyway. It's an imponderable, yes. But regardless of whether, you know, whether we can predict it or not, we will continue searching.
One of the standard assumptions is that the objects we see are steady in their flux. But
right.
In fact, you would expect supernovae to outshine the galaxies by, if you're talking about the feeble sources,
yeah.
A single supernova. And since we have the redshift factor 1 plus z, they could shine like that for a year or so.
Right.
And so do you see evidence for transient sources?
It just so happens that the redshift 10 object, which I was going to come to, could well be a transient object. There was this excitement, and this is what I think Barry was talking about. This object at redshift 10 that Rosa found, and I think, you know, it's exactly the same idea. Here's the critical line of a different cluster, and here's the continuum drop, and they were very lucky because they, you know, had a claim to have a Lyman alpha as well. But this has turned out to be amazingly controversial. Firstly, the object is not seen with a deeper image with Gemini. Okay, you can see, I mean, just compare this other object here, which is definitely there in the Gemini image, barely there in the VLT image, and then, you know, here's this smudge of whatever. not mayonnaise. And then there's nothing in the Gemini image. And then, you know, Rosa's recently posted a paper which, you know, where she worries that this object may actually be variable. But so, you know, there may be transients out there, and so we should continue to look for them. Yeah, right?